In 1520, the famous Renaissance Italian painter Raphael completed his very last work. His final painting is actually a portrayal of what I just read from the Gospel of Mark. You can turn inside your bulletin to the very back cover, and you can actually see a copy of Raphael's famous masterpiece, this final work of his. St. Philip's actually has a copy of it just down the hall from my office, over in the office building. I've passed it probably 100 times, and I've never actually noticed that it was about our passage. At first glance, when you look at it, what stands out is Jesus floating up above the mountain. And so if you're like me, my mind went to Jesus' ascension into heaven from the Mount of Olives. However, thanks to our wonderful rector, who never misses a detail, I learned that this painting isn't about Jesus' ascension into heaven. It's about his transfiguration and the events that follow. Mark chapter 9 begins with Jesus' transformation. That's the immediate context of what I just read in our passage. And the whole point of Raphael's painting is to help us see that Jesus' transfiguration and our passage this morning, they go hand in hand. They must be read together, and we'll see why in a bit. But look with me at the painting. In the beginning of Mark chapter 9, Jesus takes his closest three disciples, Peter, James, and John, and he goes up onto a high mountain, and there he's transfigured before their eyes. His appearance becomes dazzling and radiant, and Moses and Elijah appear with him. Those are the two figures floating next to Jesus, Moses there on our right, holding the law of God, which is penned by Moses, is what Moses represents. And on the left, we see Elijah. He's representing the prophets of the Old Testament. And so the transfiguration, in a sense, shows us that all of the Old Testament, the law and the prophets, it's all pointing to Jesus. It's Jesus who's the climax and the goal of the Old Testament. So just below Jesus there on the mountain, we see Peter, James, and John. They're awestruck at the sight of Jesus' glory. They fall down and cover their eyes because of its brightness. And the reason that Jesus' transfiguration is so important is that this is the one instance before Jesus' death and resurrection where we most clearly see who Jesus really is. More than his virgin birth, more than his amazing authoritative teaching, even more than the miracles that he performed, Jesus' transfiguration shows us that he clearly is God. As the Christmas hymn puts it, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity. On the Mount of Transfiguration, the veil is pulled back, so to speak, if only for a moment. And Peter, James, and John, they catch a glimpse of who Jesus really is. They see that he is God. They see his divine glory. But one of the things that's so beautiful about Raphael's depiction is how he captures the contrast between what's going up on the mountain and what's going down below the mountain. You see, up on the mountain, there's light and glory, but down below, there's darkness and trouble. And Raphael's taking some artistic license here. The people down below, they wouldn't be able to see what was happening up on the Mount of Transfiguration, but Raphael's purpose is to highlight this contrast between these two scenes. You have glory one minute, and then the very next you have evil. You have light one moment, and then darkness. That's what's happening in Mark chapter 9. Peter, James, and John, they experience what is perhaps the first Christian mountaintop experience. They behold Jesus' glory. They're filled with awe and wonder. They feel this nearness to God. And then they come down the mountain and everything changes. The scribes are arguing with the disciples. The disciples themselves are inept and confused. Peter, James, and John, they leave this glorious mountaintop and all of a sudden they're in contact with a demon. Forces of evil. That's all happening down below the mountain. And what stands out most in the picture is what's happening with this father and his son. The intense suffering of them both. You can see the boy being held by his father on the bottom right there. You can see the urgency and desperation on the father's face. Our passage reminds us this morning that oftentimes trouble comes right on the heels of glory. It happened with Jesus right after his baptism. It happens here right after his transfiguration. And it happens in our lives, the lives of his followers, all the time. Jesus was quite clear to his disciples. He said, in this world, you will have tribulation. He warned them that this is something that all of his followers need to be prepared for. Everyone, in fact, not just Jesus' disciples, all of us need to be prepared to face suffering and hardship because no one is immune to these things. And how you respond to the suffering and the hardship and the trials of your life is critically important. Tim Keller once noted that suffering, it always has a polarizing effect on people. It will either make you bitter, joyless, hard, seared, or it will make you wiser and deeper, softer and stronger and sweeter. It will either drive you to God or away from God. It will make you either more compassionate towards others or it will make you more cynical about human nature. All of us are guaranteed trials in this life, and the critical question that we must be prepared to answer is, how are we going to respond when they inevitably come our way? So this morning, as we look at our passage in Mark 9, let's ask this passage that very question. What does it teach us about how we should face the adversity in our lives? The simple answer, the big idea of the passage is really simple. I almost hesitate to say it, but it's this. Have faith. Have faith in Jesus. That's how we are to respond when we face adversity. And I hesitate almost to say that because that phrase, just have faith, has become cliche. Hearing those words conjures up notions of irrational belief for most people. It's almost synonymous now with a blind or even foolish hope, either in the face of a lack of evidence or worse, evidence to the contrary. Most people don't really understand what it really means to have faith, and they certainly don't have an idea of practically what it looks like to have faith. But that's exactly what this passage is teaching us, and thankfully it gives us a concrete picture. This passage shows us two practical things about what it means to have faith in Jesus when facing adversity. Let's look at both of them. The first thing that this passage shows us is that true faith does not begin with our holiness, but our helplessness. True faith doesn't begin with our holiness, but our helplessness. Look with me at the passage. Peter, James, and John, they come down the mountain with Jesus, and they find the scribes arguing with the other disciples. The argument has to do with this boy and his father. Jesus enters into dialogue with this father. He wants to heal, or the father wants wants Jesus to heal his son. And Jesus says these words, "All things are possible for him who believes." Essentially, what Jesus is saying is, if you have faith in me, I'll heal your son. What does the father say in return? Okay, I believe. Not quite. He says, "I believe. Help my unbelief." Translation, "I believe, but oh my goodness, I have doubts." Kent Hughes calls this unbelieving faith. The father is saying that he believes, but his belief isn't quite pure. It's not perfect. He's still filled with doubt and uncertainty. And the astonishing thing is, in all of this, Jesus doesn't rebuke him. He doesn't say, "Come back when your faith is pure. Get back to me when you've gotten rid of all your doubts and all your double-mindedness." No, Jesus says, "Believe in me and I'll heal your son." And the father says, "I believe, but I'm riddled with doubt." And then the very next thing Jesus does is he heals his son. Why? I want you to notice in this entire scene, the father is the only one who's admitting his weakness. He's the only one admitting his helplessness. In fact, he's a complete foil to Jesus' own disciples who couldn't heal this man's son, because of their lack of faith. We learn at the very last line of the passage that the disciples tried to perform essentially an exorcism without praying. How ridiculous is that? how arrogant to try to exorcise a demon without praying to God. They were, in fact, able to cast out demons earlier in Mark's gospel, in Mark 6, but here they can't. And the reason is they're trying to do so in their own strength without relying on God. You see, prayer in its very essence is its relying and depending and turning to God. That's what enabled them to cast the demons out before. But now they're so self-confident, so self-sufficient that they try to heal this boy in their own strength and they fail miserably. This father's faith tells us something really important about what it really means to have true faith. You see, true faith does not begin by getting our act together. It's not about getting rid of our doubts before we come to Jesus. It's not about being good enough for Jesus to accept us. Now, this man responds to Jesus' call to faith by saying, okay, I believe, but boy, I'm a mess. And my faith isn't pure, and I need your help, Jesus. And Jesus says, I can work with that. I can work with that. True faith doesn't start with our holiness, but our helplessness. It's not about the quality or the strength or how pure our faith is. It's all about the object of our faith. Which direction are you looking? When Jesus tells him, all things are possible for the one who believes, where does that father then turn? Where does he go? Notice he doesn't turn away. He doesn't go off and think for a bit. And he doesn't delay. The next thing that we read is it says immediately. True faith is immediately turning to Jesus and crying for help. That's the picture. It's exactly what the father does. True faith always begins by crying to God for help. The Psalms are full of this. Psalm 77 says, I cry aloud to God and he will hear me. That's the promise of our passage. It's the promise of the Bible. Jesus delights in hearing the cries of his people for help. My friends, where do you go when you face adversity? Do you double down in your own strength? Don't turn inward. Don't look elsewhere. And don't delay. Cry to Jesus right in the midst of your adversity, with all your doubts, with all your confusion. And the guarantee of the scriptures is that God is the helper of his people. It's the offertory that we're going to hear in a little bit. He oversees his people, and he delights to hear them when they cry for help. The foundation of true faith is not look at how worthy I am, but it's instead, Lord, I'm a wreck. I need your help. True faith does not start with our holiness, but our helplessness. And that's great news for those of us right now in the midst of trial and suffering and adversity. But the second thing this passage teaches us is much more difficult to hear. I'm just going to warn you. The second thing we learn about true faith is that it means that we must entrust our most precious things to Jesus, even when it seems like he's going to make everything worse. True faith means entrusting our most precious things to Jesus, even if it seems like he is going to make everything worse. Do you notice in the passage, which is all about exorcising a demon, it's not really about the demon. The stress so much more is on the suffering son and the anxiety and the desperation of this father. The father says to Jesus, I brought my son to you for help. He has a spirit that makes him mute, and whenever it seizes him, it throws him on the ground, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. The father's son is suffering. Many of you know firsthand what it's like to experience the suffering of a child, to watch that happen. Years ago, my wife and I woke up in the middle of the night to shrieking screams coming from my five-year-old's room. We rushed in there, and we saw him sitting up straight in his bed, and he was shaking uncontrollably. And we turned on a lamp, and I could see tears on his cheeks and fear in his eyes. And he was speaking so fast, Molly and I couldn't understand a word he was saying. We couldn't figure out what was happening. We just did some of this. We said, Jesus, help. And we tried to hold him and comfort him. And he was convulsing. He was stiff as a board. And he was scared, but I think we were even more scared. I was flushed. My heart was pounding. Adrenaline was coursing through me. I remember feeling physically just repulsed and sick watching my child go through this. It was a feeling of utter helplessness because I couldn't alleviate my child's suffering. You know what I'm talking about. Now, my son ended up being just fine. We didn't know it at the time, but these were night terrors, which were actually fairly common. But even there, that was acute suffering. Many of you, like this boy's father in the story, knows just how painful and helpless it is to have a child with chronic suffering or terminal illness. Just this week, I met with someone who has a family member suffering from Batten's disease. I've never even heard of that disease before this week. It's a fatal disease that affects the nervous system. It's usually detectable between the ages of 5 and 10, and essentially what happens is the child's development begins to go in reverse at that point. The neurological system degenerates, sight and speech decline, seizures can occur. Life expectancy is usually between the teen years and mid-20s. It's just a horrible thing to think about. Parents of children with chronic suffering know exactly this sort of desperation and helplessness, which you can see in the eyes of this father. You can almost feel his agony when he tells Jesus, "I brought my son to your disciples to cast out this demon, and they were not able." I think Jesus' compassion for this father leads to his exasperated response. One commentator says, Jesus has had enough of unbelief. He tells him, "Bring the boy to me." And as the boy comes close to Jesus, he begins to have one of his epileptic fits. He starts convulsing on the ground. And this would have been really perhaps out of the ordinary for those around him. But you have to remember, for this father and this boy, this was everyday life. Day after day, year after year, the father watched his precious son suffer like this. And Jesus asked this father to believe in him, to bring his suffering son to him, to entrust what probably was the most precious thing in this father's life at that time to Jesus. And look at what happens in verse 25 and 26. The moment Jesus begins to deal with this son, it gets worse. He goes from being deaf and mute to being dead. You see that? It says Jesus commanded this spirit to leave him, and he's left dead like a corpse. I want you to see that from the father's perspective, he was entrusting his most precious thing in the world, and Jesus just made everything worse, it seems like. He's not just deaf and mute anymore. It seems like he's dead. See, what happens with this father in an instant is what happens to many Christians over a long period of time. Because I'm a pastor, I usually hear this from folks. You know, I became a Christian, and ever since that day, life's actually gone worse. I put my faith in Jesus, and it's been downhill ever since. And to be honest, that can happen. Because Jesus doesn't promise that the circumstances and the situations in our lives are guaranteed necessarily to improve the moment we trust in him. Jobs can still be lost. The stock market can crash. Those that we love and friends that we have, they can still betray us. The details of our lives can and often do get worse when we place our faith in Jesus. When you become a Christian, you also have a whole new set of struggles. You have a whole new set of issues that come your way because now you wage war against the world and its natural tendency to go from God. And the flesh, these internal desires that we have that draw us from the love of God, we're resisting the spiritual forces of wickedness. It gets harder. So if Jesus, if trusting him with our most precious things doesn't necessarily mean that the circumstances in our lives will automatically get better, then why do it? Why trust him with it, our most precious things in this life? And the only answer is because trusting Jesus is the only way that you'll walk through suffering, which is going to come to you whether you like it or not, and not become hard and bitter and cynical. You see, it's a good thing to love your children. It's a good thing to want to have a spouse and a romantic relationship. It's a good thing to want to serve people and help them and to have a job and work and to want to leave a legacy. These things are good and they should be precious to you. But when they become the ultimate thing in your life, when they become the true source of your happiness and your identity and your meaning, and they don't go the way you had hoped, when they begin to be threatened, when they begin to fail, you won't just be sad, which you should be. You won't just be hurting as you ought to be. You'll be despairing. You'll be utterly despondent. Why? Because these things, as good as they are, were never meant to bear the weight of your soul. There's only one who was meant for that. It's the Lord Jesus Christ, God Himself. And when you trust Him with your most precious things, you will find that even when everything's falling apart, the things of this world, which you value so much, when they suffer and break down, you will be sad, yes, but you will also find a hope and a buoyancy and a peace that passes all understanding. You'll find that you can say along with Job, "The Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." You might be saying, "That sounds wonderful. I'm not sure if I can do that." How do you actually get to the point where you can bring your precious things to Jesus and entrust them to Him? I'll tell you how. It's why what happened on the Mountain of Transfiguration is so important. Think about this. And all the people in this scene, who are the ones most likely to trust in Jesus at this very point when all is falling apart, when this son seems to be getting worse? Who do you think? It's Peter and James and John, right? They know something that all the others don't know. They just saw it. They remember who this really is. And despite everything going on at the bottom of the mountain, despite their limited knowledge and their lack of understanding about the future, they're the ones who are most likely to be saying to themselves, "I don't know how this is going to play out, but just you wait. Just wait." And when we consider Raphael's painting and the two scenes that we have before us, we learn something about the heart of God that's really important. You see, in ancient Greek mythology, they had a term for when their great heroes, these great men, would become gods. It was called apotheosis. And Hercules, if you think of that story, was an example of that. They taught that Hercules was born a man. He lived such a heroic life that eventually he was promoted to a higher status, and he was elevated to become a god. And he ascended another mountain, Mount Olympus, and he entered into heaven to stay there where the gods belong. And I want you to think how absolutely different Jesus is compared to that. You know what this passage tells us about the heart of God? Jesus didn't become a God. He was always and forever God. That's what we saw on the Mount of Transfiguration. But His heart was so moved by His sin-sick and suffering creation that He was moved to take on flesh. He didn't ascend a mountain to go into Mount Olympus. He descended the mountain to come into your and my mess. He descended the mountain, and He plunged Himself into the suffering of this world. He came to draw near to the heartache and the pain of the life of this Father and His Son. You want to know how you can trust God with your most precious things? Look at Jesus coming down the mountain. Look at Jesus drawing near to the pain of this world. He doesn't just know it from a distance. God just doesn't know in theory about your and my pain. He's tasted it Himself. He's intimately familiar with it by His own experience. And He didn't just come down this mountain for this father and his boy. He came down for you and for me. And despite the constant urging of His disciples to keep Him from suffering, He came down the mountain so that He could go all the way to the cross to experience the worst kind of suffering imaginable. He drank the bitter cup of the sins of the world, and it consumed Him so that it wouldn't consume us. He came down to become well acquainted with us in all our adversities. He didn't just come to sympathize, thank goodness. He came to do something about it, because 3 days after his death, he rose again, and he broke the bonds of death. It was no match for him. The sin and suffering that brought him down was defeated once and for all. And the world's never been the same. You see, the resurrection of Jesus, it's the great reversal of history. As Tolkien said, it's the moment when everything sad is becoming untrue. It's the moment when sin's natural course of decay is reversed and becoming undone. It's the down payment and the foretaste that God will one day make all things right. Friends, what Jesus does when he reaches out and he takes this little boy's hand, it's the same thing that he's going to do with everyone who looks to him in faith. He will one day raise them up with him. So, beloved, God has seen you in your helpless estate. He's taken notice of your suffering. He is personally aware and knows what it's like to be sore oppressed. And he's come to bring healing. How can you trust Jesus with your most precious things? Can't you see how strong he is and how kind he is to be trusted with our most precious things? Because either in this life or in the next, he will bring the healing that we so desperately need. Friends, how are we to face the adversity in our lives? We must put our faith in Jesus. It's that simple. And that starts not with our holiness, but with our helplessness and turning to him, crying help. And it means bringing to Jesus our most precious things in this life and remembering who he is and what he's done. Do this, and you can say, along with Horatio Spafford, the famous hymn writer, the one who wrote a hymn we'll sing at communion, he lost all four of his children in a shipwreck at sea. And later, he passed over the very spot, and he wrote these words: "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul." Amen.